All right, I think we're going to go ahead and get started.
Yeah, I won't mess with you.
We might have one or two more come in a little late, but we'll go ahead and get started. I'm Chris Wood. I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife for the southeastern part of the state. And usually our RAC chairman is the one who gets their meeting started and welcomes everyone, but we don't have a chairman yet. But that's part of the matters of business that we'll need to do before we dive too far into the agenda. But we have a ton of new RAC members today. I think we have 8 new RAC members total. And so I thought maybe we could go around the room and we could introduce ourselves. Maybe state your name, where you live, who you represent, and what your interest in wildlife is. So maybe we'll start with Commissioner Brady.
Commissioner Keith Brady with Emery County. My interest in wildlife is just really good management and making sure that everyone has access. Use either mic.
My name's Todd Thorne. I'm public at large. I live in Price. I'm just someone who's interested in hunting and other outdoor activities.
Okay, Darren Olson. Live in Farron. I'm with the Forest Service. So federal rep, enjoy the outdoors, fishing, hunting, camping, getting outside. So,
Eric Luke, I live in Farron as well. I'm the sportsman's rep. Hunting and outdoors is my passion. I've done it my entire life and pretty long time.
Jeff Christensen from Price. I'm an agricultural representative. We have a little bit of a hunting business in the fall.
I'm Sue Bellagamba from Moab, and my interest is mostly in rare species.
I'm Trish Hedin. I'm from Moab, and I represent sportsmen.
Colleen Taylor, I'm from Moab also, and I represent agricultural, and just passionate about hunting and wildlife management.
My name's Dana Truman, and I work for the BLM, so I'm one of the, I guess, representatives for the federal government, and I live in Price, Utah, and I've always loved wildlife from the ecosystem perspective, as well as hunting and the rare species, so I'm excited to be here.
Jay Skyman. I live in Cleveland. I just really enjoy hunting. I do quite a bit of guiding and a lot of hunting for myself, and just spend a whole lot of time in the woods every year, and that's my interest.
I'm Kirk Player. It's a public at large position, and I just like most all wildlife and a lot of them. So.
Daryl Meekum Sportsman's representing from Green River now. Been here for a while. I guess I'm on the old ones here now, huh? Talked on this by Walt. Thank you, Walt.
Never paid attention.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Should say our wildlife board rep for the southeastern region was Mike King for 6 years. And after a thorough search and our new wildlife board member that will represent the southeastern region is Kevin Albrecht, and so he's here. When I congratulate him, he'll begin his first meeting later this month, and he'll serve for 6 years. So he knows the process well, and he'll be represent us well. So he works for the Forest Service, but correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but his representation has nothing to do with the Forest Service. He'll represent independently of that, and just be a regular board member. So, just a few housekeeping items. I think everyone in front of them has this form right here. And this is the form that you all serve voluntarily, and we appreciate your service. We do reimburse you for your mileage and for a meal tonight. So if you look at this form, if you could fill out all of the areas in red on the top of the front page, you need to put the date in the middle of the front page, and then sign your name at the bottom of the front page. And if you turn it over, if you just put, you know, the date and time you left and where you're traveling from, you can claim $18 in dinner. And then at the bottom of the back page, if you drove your own vehicle here, you can put down the mileage, round trip mileage, and we'll reimburse you. And so at the end of the night, you can give this slip to myself or Morgan, and we'll get that processed in the next few days, and you'll have a check sent to your address, whatever address you put on the front page here, within a week or two or so. So that's how we do our mileage and meal reimbursements. So, and if for some reason you forget as you leave, you can always mail this to me or email it to me, and we'll get you reimbursed. Any questions about that? Okay, and I think I told you for our we have a RAC and Wildlife Board training at the end of the month, and it'll be this exact same form that we'll have you fill out when you do go there. And if you would like to spend the night in a hotel the night before, because it does start, you know, if you're coming from a long ways, you might want to do that, or you can get up really early, your choice. The state per diem reimbursement rate is $100 for the Salt Lake area, and so just bring your receipt and attach to this form, and we'll get you reimbursed. But as far as gas receipts or dinner receipts, we don't need any of those receipts at all. We'll give you the rate that we reimburse for mileage and the rate that we reimburse for meals. We don't need any receipts, only hotel receipts. Okay. I guess I will give us our RAC and board updates, or our board updates. Our board meeting, the last board meeting we had was June 1st. And if you remember, we had what I thought was going to be a pretty short RAC meeting at our back in May. Only a few agenda items. And we said goodbye to our outgoing RAC members. But it was a longer meeting than I thought. So our RAC... we accepted the division's recommendations as proposed for the upland game hunt and the turkey hunt, and the board did as well. The big discussion item at our last meeting was the falconry rule. We had some falconers here, and they asked the RACs and the board to accept the division's recommendation, with the exception that of this 54 species list. They wanted that to be excluded. And so there was a lot of discussion at all five RACs about that list of 54 species. Our RAC was kind of mixed. Some felt that more restriction above and beyond a federal restriction was not necessary. And other RAC members felt that the division had thoroughly researched this, and they supported the division's proposal. And so we actually had a 3-3 tie, and our chairman ended up breaking the tie, and our RAC ended up voting to accept the division's proposal. The other RACs in the states, I think three of the RACs voted to exclude the 54 list. This 54 species list. The other two RACs, us in the southern region, accepted the division's proposal as presented. And so the Wildlife Board heard from a lot of falconers, showed up at the Wildlife Board meeting. It was discussed at length. And in the end, the division said, if you're going to accept this list of 54 species and deviate from our recommendation a little bit, please include these 5 points. And if you want more details, I can talk to you after the meeting. But the 5 points were to retain DWR's ability to regulate wild captive native birds, 2, to retain the proposed list of 14 species for apprentices, 3, retain the proposed general class endorsement process for large raptors, 4, improve DWR's capabilities for inspecting and monitoring raptor facilities, and 5, some non-substantive changes requested by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So the Wildlife Board ended up accepting the division's proposal with the exception of this 54 species list. So they excluded that list, and they adapted these 5 points that we recommended if they were going to exclude that. So, and that passed I think the vote was 4-1. Mike King voted against. The other members voted for. So that's the update from the last Wildlife Board meeting. Any thoughts or questions about that? Okay. Welcome, Kent. We all introduced ourselves. So maybe introduce yourself, where you're from, who you represent, and your interest in wildlife.
Kent Johnson. I'm the at-large seat. I'm from right here in Green River, which is why I'm so late.
I'm glad you're here. Welcome. Okay. I'm going to jump into our regional update. So the purpose of the next few minutes is to tell you what the Division of Wildlife Resources is doing in our region for the last since the last RAC or board meeting, and what we're doing in the upcoming weeks or months, just to keep you up to speed. And if you have any questions, you can certainly ask them. If I don't have the answers, I have a bunch of biologists and law enforcement officers here tonight that can help answer them. It's our big field season, especially for our aquatic section. They've been really busy doing several treatments, rotenone treatments to restore native cutthroat trout. Tomorrow, I believe, they'll be up in the Farron drainage. They've been up prepping all week long, but they'll be starting a rotenone treatment up in the Farron drainage. We've been up there the last few years, and we'll continue this year, both treating some stretches of the creeks that come into the to mill sites and part of the Farron drainage, and also restocking with native cutthroat trout the stretches of stream that we treated last year and the previous year. Usually treat these streams 2 years in a row before we restock them with fish. And then next week, we'll be in Range Creek, and we've worked with Butch and Jeannie Jensen and their ranch and the Preston Nutter and Sitla and BLM as a big partnership. We're treating Range Creek, and that process will also restore native cutthroat trout to that creek. We will take part in a family fishing event at the Carbon County Fair at the end of this month. Our habitat guys are gearing up for a big season. We have several WMAs, including our Gordon Creek Wildlife Management Area near Price. That's our biggest one. It's 15,000 acres of land in Carbon County. We have some water rights associated with that property. We actually grow crops for deer and elk and turkeys. And so we exercise those water rights every year and grow some fields. We've been doing that this summer. We just heard that we got funded for a bunch of projects, and so we have $1.9 million worth of project money coming to the southeastern region this year. And I say that is a combination of BLM monies and Forest Service money, and WRI stands for Watershed Restoration Initiative money. That is state money, along with these sportsmen groups. They raise a lot of money, and that almost all of it goes back to on-the-ground projects. And so that $1.9 million is a mixture of those funds and those projects that got funded. So specifically in our region, some ones that, and there's the list is really long, but there's probably 15 projects, but just a few. Grimes Wash, it's a bullhog and a pinyon juniper removal near Orangeville. We have a South Bookcliffs bullhog project. We'll also remove pinyon and juniper both by bullhogging and lop and scatter. There's some, there's the Elk Ridge prescribed fire that's gonna happen. There's a Blanding East Phase 2 project. That's also a bullhog project. There's some aspen regeneration work going up by Cold Springs, and then there's a Trail Mountain prescribed aspen regeneration project. So at some point in a future meeting, we'll have to have our habitat folks come by and tell you, give you a presentation, maybe a meeting that has a smaller agenda, and show you all the good work that they're doing. It's amazing the amount of partnerships that are coming together and the amount of money that gets pooled together to restore habitats throughout the state. That group that approves a lot of these projects is the UPCD team. It's called the Utah Partners for Conservation and Development. They have several field tours every year. They went to Miller Creek in Carbon County just a few weeks ago and looked at some of the projects that are there. That picture on the bottom right there is Miller Creek, and they've been putting in these BDAs, these Beaver Dam something, or the analog, Beaver Dam analogs. They're basically creating fake beaver dams with vegetation and post and debris and to back up the water and slow down the flow and create pools and reshape the channels. And it's been really effective in areas that we haven't been able to restore beavers in for many reasons. But so the habitat section's been doing some really good things. Our law enforcement's been busy as well. We have, they did do a saturation patrol, which means all the officers got together over the July 24th weekend and teamed up and hit the Manti. Made a lot of contacts, did a lot of education and outreach. They contacted over 560 individuals. There were a few violations they cited for, but it was great to have their presence out there and talking with our sportsmen, our anglers, and relaying our message to the public. We did have a jury trial in Monticello a few weeks ago, and the defendant was found guilty for poaching a deer. So that's always good to see our hard work, our investigative work, come together and have a successful trial and see restitution made and a verdict that we were hoping for. And, of course, our law enforcement officers, I think the archery deer hunt starts August 19th. Is that right? Okay. So from then on, for the rest of the fall, our guys will be really busy. Our outreach section's been working hard, too. They had a Meet the Bats night in Moab by Ken's Lake on July 18th. It was well attended. A lot of our non-consumptive constituents and folks attend that, and people come from all over the state, and they caught numerous bat species and had a really good night. Stayed out till like 1 or 2 a.m., I think. They stayed out till 1 or 2 a.m. That is crazy, yeah. But they like bats, and they're passionate about bats. It was a good event. This fall, we'll have a fly fishing clinic. We'll have a waterfowl hunting clinic. And then, of course, we're out there meeting with youth groups and community fisheries and holding fishing events. Our wildlife section's been doing elk classifications and pronghorn classifications throughout the region. Bison surveys will begin next week. They're also doing mountain goat surveys, and then we've been doing bat and pika surveys. We'll be doing pika surveys from now until the end of the month, I think a little bit through September as well, but on all the high elevation ranges in our region, and then they're working on CWMU renewals. And again, we'd like to invite the RAC, and if there's any of these things that caught your interest, talk to me or any of the biologists, and we'd love to invite you out and give you specific dates and times of when you can assist us. We want you to have some hands-on experience with wildlife, and we hope you feel comfortable enough to invite yourself if we forget to invite you. So whatever sparks your interest, let us know. So with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
How did the aerial survey go on the LaSalle mountain goat?
Is Dustin here? It's next week. It's next week. Next week. Okay. We'll let you know at the next RAC meeting. Remind us. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So, I usually don't run this meeting, so I'm looking forward to this next part of the agenda. We need to elect a new chairman. We also should probably elect a new vice chairman. Our chairman last time was Kevin Albrecht, whose term ended. His vice chair was Todd Huntington. So his term also is over, and so we need to elect a new chairman and a vice chair. And so at this time, I think we could accept nominations, or you can nominate yourself. Depending on how many nominees we have, we'll either do a ballot vote, or I guess we'll go from there. I should say that the role of the chairman is to run the meeting, basically, following Robert's Rules of Order, and some meeting management. I assist the chairman a little bit, and as far as meeting management goes, and making sure we're following the right process. But really, it's the chairman who runs the meeting. The chairman does vote if there is a tie, and certainly the chairman can also provide insight and ask questions. And I think we all saw Kevin do that the last few years. He didn't make motions himself. I don't know if the chairman can make motions. But he definitely provided his insight and input and led a discussion as motions were being developed too. So it's an important role. It also requires the person to go to be able to attend most of the board meetings. And most of the board meetings are on Thursdays. And it's an all-day thing, really, because it starts at 9 o'clock and they go till 2 or 3 usually. So please consider that. If there's one or two board meetings you can't make, the vice chair can step in. And if the vice chair can't step in, I have stepped in the past for the chairman's. So any questions about the role of the chairman or the vice chairman? Okay, so with that, I'll open it up to any nominations. And you can nominate yourself, too. Don't be shy.
Chris?
Yeah.
I would like to nominate Tricia Heaton as chair.
Okay. Do I need a second on that or not? How does that work? Trish, do you accept?
Not a motion, so I don't know.
Okay.
Is it?
I don't think it is. I think you're right.
I think first.
Okay. So, Trish, do you accept the nomination? Okay. Any other nominations?
Should I make a motion now?
I'd make a motion that we accept Tricia Heaton by acclamation.
Okay. All in favor of accepting Trish as our RAC chairman? All in favor?
Aye.
Raise your hand. Okay. Any opposed? Okay. We need a vice chair. Anybody want to be a vice chair? And Trish is going to be at every single meeting, so, you know. I'm just kidding.
I'd nominate Kent Johnson. No offense.
Kent, do you accept the nomination? Okay. Any other nominations? Do I hear a motion? Okay. Motion to accept to make Kent Johnson our vice chair. All in favor? Everyone? Okay, anybody opposed? Okay, congratulations. Thank you for your service. So I'll hand the meeting over to you, Trish. I bought this book for you called Robert's Rules of Orders, and then it was 700 pages long. So then I also bought you Robert's Rules for Dummies. And I have a gavel for you, too.
You want me to run the meeting now?
Oh, my gosh.
Really?
So we'll help you through this first meeting, Trish. But for those in our public that's here and those don't know, there's a process that we have. And it's on this paper here that you might have picked up as you walked into the door. So for each agenda item, you'll hear a presentation. Usually the presentations are from our Salt Lake office coordinators. Sometimes they're from our regional personnel. But at the end of the presentation, the chairman will ask the RAC if they have any questions or if they need any clarification on the presentation. The chairman will then ask the audience if they have any questions. And if the audience doesn't have any questions, the chairman will call them up and ask them to state their name and ask them to state their question. We make sure that it's only a question time. And then at the end of the period for questions and clarifications, after the audience is able to ask questions, the chairman will then allow the audience to make comments. If the audience would like to make any comments, they need to fill out a comment card and give it to me. And the comment cards are in the front of the room here. And so I'll collect comment cards. Usually throughout the meeting, I'll get some handed to me. Sometimes at the beginning of the meeting, I get these handed to me. But we'll call up those people who have filled out a comment card. If you represent yourself, you get 3 minutes for the comments, and I will keep the time. If you represent an organization, you get 5 minutes for your comment. Once all the public comments have been received, the chairman will close the comment period for the audience, and at that point, the RAC will discuss and deliberate these issues and make motions for each topic. Clear as mud? Okay. I think we're ready to proceed. So, it's yours.
Okay, so we are going to have Gary come and tell us about rule amendments for Hunter Education.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
We need to approve the minutes and the agenda from the last meeting.
Sorry. I can't believe you just threw this.
We're on your side, Trish.
Do we do them at the same time, or do you do them one at a time? Okay. Can I just say that? Do we have a motion to approve the agenda and minutes from the last meeting?
So moved.
So we have a motion by Kent and seconded by Keith to approve the agenda and minutes from the last meeting. Okay with that? All in favor? All opposed?
Instant state passed unanimously.
Passed unanimously.
So I should state that we used to have a, our minute taker used to come to our meetings. Our minute taker now lives in New Mexico. And so I did a very poor job in the beginning of stating, you did a very good job. I liked how you stated so-and-so made the motion, so-and-so seconded. That'll help our minute taker. So to backtrack on my thing, Sue Bellagamba nominated Trish Heaton as chairman. And was it seconded by anybody? I don't know if we did that.
Kent Johnson made the motion.
And Johnson made the motion. Okay, Kent Johnson made the motion to...
Never got seconded.
And then who seconded it?
No one.
No one did. Okay. Well, it passed unanimously. And then and then who proposed Kent Johnson as vice? It was Keith Brady. Eric Luke made the motion?
I nominated Kent.
Okay. Okay, so it was nominated by Eric Luke, motioned by Keith Brady. It passed unanimously.
Okay, if there's any opposed, okay.
Yeah. And then when the audience comes up, if you can state your name, that'd be great too.
So can we move on to the presentation? Okay, great. By Gary for the Hunter Education Rule Amendment.
Thank you. Got a few or presentation on a few amendments, proposed amendments to our Hunter Education Administrative Rule. This past legislative session, we had a bill that went through, passed through the legislative session, House Bill 67. This bill did a couple of different things. First of all, it clarified the existing education requirement, made a few changes to language there, but basically that requirement states that it prohibits an individual from acquiring or possessing a hunting license or permit or a fur harvester license without having successfully completed an approved education course. The real focus of this bill was to allow the Wildlife Board the flexibility to establish criteria and standards of an approved education course and establish the procedure for verifying that an individual has successfully completed an approved course. This previously existed in statute, but they made these changes so we can put that in the administrative rule. So the problem that we've been dealing with, in the past, individuals were allowed to enter their own hunter education numbers in the system. This led to a lot of inaccurate records, and it also did make it possible to defraud the system. People maybe thought they knew their hunter education number, would transpose numbers, maybe enter a license number rather than a hunter education number. Also, if they weren't sure, the system had some parameters, but they were able to sometimes enter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and the system would accept that. So that gave us a lot of problems and inaccuracies with the system and those hunter education records. So some of the proposed amendments that we have now with the administrative rule, as I said, first of all, just procedures for verifying course completion. So in a nutshell, at the time of application, when a person is applying for a license or permit, they have three options. They either have to already be in the division's customer database with a valid hunter education number, or they have to provide the division with a certificate of completion, whether that's a Utah card, a blue card, or a document from another state that has that completion noted on it. If they can't provide, if they're not in there, can't provide that, then they do have an option at that time to certify by a sworn statement. They can self-certify that they have completed an approved course, but you know, are not in the system currently and don't haven't been able to provide that proof at that point in time. If that's the option that they choose, that self-certification, then the division, we can go back and research those individuals, go through and research their education records to verify that they have completed it and it's an approved course. Anybody that we cannot verify then must go through and successfully complete an approved course before they can obtain a license or permit. Other proposed amendments to the rule, there's several modifications to the definition of terms. This includes those criteria and standards for those approved education courses, hunter ed or for harvester ed. Aligns with the updated program procedures that we're engaging in now. And then addresses that addition of for harvester education in the administrative rule. Previously, for harvester basically existed in statute, and we relied solely on that statute for how we administered that program. The bill specifically called out the inclusion of for harvester education, so those differences are now spelled out in the administrative rule. So with these proposed amendments to the hunter ed rule, this will help us find that balance and to be able to ensure hunter safety out in the field, but also provide the customer service that hunters need and expect. The new process also addresses those problems with being able to enter numbers and avoids those mistakes and errors with entering their own number. It's important to note, though, really the public will only see very minor changes in how they obtain a license or permit. This is basically the process that we're asking the public to go through currently. A lot of these are housekeeping rules and updates with our administrative rule to bring us in line with those current practices. Also important to note that the trial hunting program is not affected by any of these amendments. The trial hunting program remains an exception to the hunter education rule and still an easy way to introduce new hunters to the sport with a qualified mentor supervising them. That's really all I have for the presentation, unless there's additional questions.
So at this time, if the RAC has questions or need clarification, ask Gary.
I have a question. Just looking through the wording in there, it crossed out having passed. Yeah. And added successfully completing a course. What constitutes successfully completing? Does it require a passing grade, or you know, is there a test? Is there something that says they actually learned something and are qualified, or is it a participation trophy?
We actually still have there's three testing components to our hunter education course. Whether it's an in-person instructor-led classroom course, traditional type course, or an online instruction accompanied with a field day, there's a written test that the students have to be able to complete and score 75% on that written test. Additionally, there is a live fire component to the hunter education course What they're tested on there is safe gun handling, their attitude, their ability to follow instructions and be safe with a firearm. There's also a component in there for we call it attitude, just based on the student's behavior in class. They can be failed just on that merit alone. So those are the three components that we have in the course right now. And then all of the our courses, as well as any other, the language in the rule, it will either meet or exceed the International Hunter Education Association's minimum standards for a course, or in the case of other states, it will either meet that minimum standard, or by successfully completing their course, it allows them to obtain a hunting license or permit in their home state of residence.
Okay, thank you.
So is the division going to recognize every other state's hunter education program, or is there criteria where that wouldn't be the case?
Currently, we do have reciprocity with every other state, most Canadian provinces. There's some recommendations from that International Hunter Education Association, again, on foreign countries, but that's a decision made at our director's office level for that reciprocity. It's one of the reasons that we put the language in there. We may not be able to, another state may or may not hit that International Hunter Ed minimum standard requirement, but if in that state it allows them to, you know, completion of that course allows them to hunt in their state, then that's what we will consider an approved course. But yes, right now we accept all other states' courses.
So I apply in Nevada, which their system is identical. When I moved through that system, at one junction it stopped me, and I had to mail in a copy of my blue card. And then I got an email that then allowed me to continue with my application process. And I put in, for example, my brother and nephew in this state, and it just pops up, do you have Hunter Ed? And all I have to do is push yes, and off we go. And so what you're telling me is, at then that junction, somebody is investigating whether they have finished Hunter Ed?
Yeah, we receive a list from our licensing section of all of the individuals that have self-certified, selected that option. And then we go through and we start off with just trying to fix those records, researching that those individuals. A lot of times our education database and our customer database just aren't synced up. We need to correct some of those errors that may be there. If we can't do that, then we're sending a letter to those individuals that they have to provide that proof to us.
Great.
If they self-certify and you investigate it, can you investigate whether, like, say they're from Nevada, and you have the ability to search that database and say, oh yeah, sure enough, they have a Nevada safety?
Yeah, if we've requested the information, they can't provide it to us. We regularly contact other states and verify hunter education from those individuals from other states.
That's great. So if there's no more questions from the rack, I'll ask if the audience has any questions at this time. Are there any comments from the audience?
I don't have any comment cards for this item.
Okay. All right, so we'll close time for comments. And at this point, we'll look for motions on this topic.
Make a motion to accept the hunter education requirements as presented by the division.
Okay, so we have a motion to accept the recommendations of the division by Kent. Do we have a second? Okay, we have a second by Helene. Motion, do we vote now? Okay. And so everybody in favor? It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I
So we now have a presentation by Darren. How do you say your last name? DeBlois for Fur Bearer Rule Amendments.
Too heavy-handed, I guess. Otherwise, I'll raise it. I appreciate the opportunity tonight. I've got a few things, and I'll try to represent these things concisely. Obviously, if you have questions on the topic, I'd be happy to answer them. The first item I want to cover is fur bearer trapping and rule recommendations. This rule is R657-11. Some of you who've were here last year may recall that we actually made some amendments to this rule last year, a fairly significant number of amendments. One of the amendments we made has caused a little bit of confusion out there. What we did is we changed the rule so that it only applied to protected wildlife species. So non-protected species weren't covered by our trapping rule. The Trappers Association, the current president and vice president and secretary, current leadership of the Trappers Association, met with me, I believe, in early spring and had some concerns about that designation. The first is that they're concerned about representing trapping in an ethical light. They were afraid that if people were trapping coyotes specifically, is what they brought up, and not following trapping rules, trapping over bait, not checking their traps, that could be detrimental to the sport of trapping in the state. And they wanted to foster good ethics within that community. Secondarily, our law enforcement folks had some concerns along those lines. They'd started to encounter people in the field that were they felt were trapping for protected wildlife species, but then claimed they're trapping for coyotes, so they weren't checking their traps. Makes it very difficult or impossible to make a case if you can't prove that they were targeting protected species. And so we wanted to try and firm up that those two things in the rule and see if we couldn't come up with some changes that would address those two concerns. The first question that arises when you start talking about non-protected species is, does the Division of Wildlife Resources have authority to manage anything related to specifically coyotes and raccoons? And we don't. Coyotes and raccoons are considered under the auspices of the Utah Department of Agriculture. They're considered agricultural pests. But there's a recent study. It's actually not quite out yet, but the data has been collected and analyzed by the Association for Fish and Wildlife Agencies, which is sort of the North American group that represents fish and wildlife agencies throughout the West, and has developed the best management practices for trapping in North America. Some of their new data shows that there is a significant risk anytime that you put a trap in the field of trapping a non-targeted animal. People sometimes catch deer, they sometimes catch eagles, bobcats if they're trapping for coyotes, that kind of thing. Given that risk, the division feels like it does fall within our authority then to regulate trapping activity in the state because of the risk to protected wildlife species, even if people are targeting non-protected wildlife. So here are the recommended changes. First is that any trapping that takes place outside of 100 feet of an outbuilding occupied by humans or livestock must comply with trapping rules established by the Utah Wildlife Board and specifically list coyotes and raccoons. Secondly, person must possess a valid trap registration license to place trapping devices in Utah outside of the area that above, outside of that buffer around people's properties there. That is similar to what we have now is a trap registration number. A person has to have a number they put on their traps. If people currently have that number, we will simply transfer that number to this new license at no cost. We'll handle it on our end and send those out. If people aren't currently in the system or don't currently have a trap registration number, they'll need to purchase this license. It'll cost $10. It's a one-time fee, and that license will have your trap number, and that will be your number for the rest of your career. Another change is that a person must carry the trap registration license while they're in the field, and that will be available on our app on the phone, so that would suffice if you have that downloaded. And finally, it provides some criminal liability protection for people who are out there doing their best and then they catch on accident a protected wildlife species, provided that they were not attempting to take unauthorized species. They possess the trap license. They possess all the necessary licenses, permits, and tags for the activity they're participating in, and that they otherwise provide with the wildlife code. And so, in other words, if you're trapping for coyotes, you accidentally catch a cougar or a bobcat, you won't be held criminally liable as long as you're complying with all of these all of our trapping regulations, the trap check, the trap specifications, you've got numbers on your traps, you've got the licenses, all those things. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the RAC at this time?
A question. So with the trap license, they're still required to have the number on their trap,
right?
Correct?
Yeah, the idea is that people setting traps will comply with, so our officers then can identify whose devices those are, and that helps them to figure out who's doing what out there. So, yeah.
Is this any trap, live trap, foot trap, any trap?
Any trap, yeah.
Well, I have a question. Maybe this ain't the time to do it. That it pertains to trapping around dead deer and elk. Uh-huh. You know, and the reason I hit that is I had three dogs snared last year. They were snared up by a dead deer.
Right.
Now, that's like the ultimate baiting in the world. We have all these rules on baiting. That is that something you guys did for coyotes or what?
They, you know what, I don't have a detailed recollection of the history. I know they changed it to allow you to set within 30 feet of a carcass as long as you didn't dump it there if it was in the field. And that was something that changed when they redid things last year. I don't know that I know all of the, you know, they had a committee and they discussed it. I wasn't there for those discussions, so I'm not sure exactly what the discussion was around that. But they would still need to comply with all the checking times and all the rest on that. But obviously, you know, this is an opportunity to discuss other things in the rule as well.
I did have one question. It's actually just changes you made under license, permit, tag requirements. You've made right. Everything singular,
yeah,
pertaining to bobcat. I was curious about why you did
that. It's probably just housekeeping. Our attorney general representative, you know, kind of goes through the rule, and sometimes there's legal reasons why they change things that really are just pertinent in the legal world. But sometimes it's just wordsmithing it. So. I think that's just housekeeping. It just
okay. I was just curious. If
yeah,
it was a change that was being made because
it won't
be going to a single take on bobcat or
no. No. It's just housekeeping. It won't make any difference. Yeah.
What did the 100 feet?
That's just the number we came up in the review committee. Just for your information, the first three racks have all changed that to 600 feet. So I don't know if that's something that you folks want to. consider as well. So it's not a magic number. The intent there was just, we don't want to regulate mouse traps and people trying to catch raccoons in their barns and things like that. We want to regulate trapping in the field, basically. So yeah.
Also, just to clarify, so if someone's out setting, you know, just normal spring trap, they catch a cougar in the middle of the summer, and that they leave that cougar in there for 8 days and it dies, they're criminally liable,
right?
Because they weren't there. So even if they're going after non-targeted, because right. that according to this new rule, they'll be subject to the trap check and right. all of that.
All the trapping rules that you saw last time are still in place. So if they're not checking their traps, they'd be liable. If they don't report it, they have 48 hours to report something like that to us. They'd be criminally liable. Yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions from the audience at this junction?
Do a lot of trapping, 48-hour check still on that coyote tag, or is that a longer duration, 48 hours?
It depends on the type of trap. So it's 48 hours for a leg hold, a non-lethal trap, and it'd be, and the intent there is that if you catch something you're not intending to catch, there's a greater chance you could release it if you found it within that time period. Lethal sets, snares, things like that, mm-hmm. is 96.
And then on my question,
your comment?
Yeah, my comment.
That'll come in a minute, I think.
Okay.
We'll call you up in a minute.
Okay.
Okay. That'll work.
Are there any more questions from the audience? Can I take his comment now?
Yeah. So now we can take your comment.
I know. Sorry, Jerry. Sorry. We're making you get up and down. We're getting you some exercise.
Ready for you.
I just want to wait.
Okay, so I didn't really know licensing was taking place tonight for this whole rack meeting. Question that I have to follow along with this is, you get a handful of licenses. The combination license to me is kind of misleading, and combination is only good for gives you the option to hunt and fish. Small game, and we have to carry for bantail pigeons, trapping, fur harvesters. Looks to me like there should be a way to do your licensing to be able to put individual species to what that license is good for, so you have the option to carry one license rather than a whole handful of them and try to set them all day through the year, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And then the six cat tags that you get, that's a lot of tags that you got to keep in your pocket through the course of the season just so that you have them in possession. So my guess, my thing is looking at some way to combine that or give you the option to add different licenses that you can foresee, because I'm going to buy a fur bearer's license from here on out, you know. Mm-hmm. So that would be an option I could select in buying my combination, and that would be included in that. So people that's chasing cougars or bears or whatever, then I give them the option of that, one less license to carry.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that and bring it up. But and I think what we've tried to do up to this point is provide that app so that, you know, you can download everything. You got your phone, you've got all your licenses there. But I'll mention that.
Right, but I don't carry my phone in the field with me because I'll lose it too.
That's yeah, I hear you.
Any more comments from the audience? All right, so it's time for us to, if we have any motions at this junction or more discussion. Yeah,
I think we have some comments.
I have a little bit of concern on the distance, number one, that I don't know how you're gonna, I guess, explain what the other have done, but
what they did is increase that 100 feet to 600 feet, similar to our shooting requirements. So that's 200 yards. The language in the rule, if you look at that red line copy, is it's fairly inclusive. So, you know, if you've got livestock that are visiting the structure, if people could, it should qualify for things like haystacks and barns and houses and outbuildings, and then you'd have this buffer, 600-foot buffer around that kind of stuff. And that's what the other racks have kind of tumbled to on a number. Again, that 100-foot is just something we came up with as seemed like it might work, but it's not.
I guess another concern I would have is just around our livestock. If you're setting, you know, I think it's a little different if you're trapping coyotes for the bounty or if you're trapping coyotes to protect your livestock. I think there's a difference there. I don't know if we can manipulate that or.
Jeff, can you just put your mic down?
What this would do is, so if you're trapping on your property away from this sort of envelope around your buildings, you'd have to have this trapping license, and you'd have to have numbers on your sets. And you wouldn't have to have a fur bearer education class. That's only for protected species. So that's what this would do. So, you know, if that's something that makes it more difficult. Again, if you've currently got a trap registration number, you'll just get the license. If you need it, you pay $10 once, and then you got it.
So I do have concerns with that I think you need. I don't know how you can draw that line, but I think you're kind of putting a burden again on somebody that now they've got to go out and get a trapper's license tag or whatever. I guess it would be the registration license for just protecting their livestock or their garden or for that.
I think gardens would fall within that. That some, buffer, some but you're right. If you're
some,
if,
some wood and some
if you're trapping, you know, fence lines out on your pastures or on your rangeland or something like that, it would
then,
change.
Then also, what you're going to do for education to educate all these old dogs that have been used to trapping stuff around their livestock their entire life? Now you're going to tell them they're going to have to go out and buy a tag. That those are my concerns.
Yeah.
Make a motion to adjust that?
I'd like to make a motion that we change the 100 feet to 600 feet like the other ones, I guess. I think that would help.
I'll second it.
Okay. So we have a motion to extend the distance from a home from 100 feet to 600 feet. And how do we attach that?
Well, you could break it up into different segments and vote on that, or you could accept the remainder of the recommendation as proposed, if you'd like. It just depends on what the discussion is, if there might be further discussion, too. So.
Okay. So can we go ahead and work on that motion?
I think that's...
Okay. So we have a motion to extend the footage from 100 feet to 600 feet. Is that correct, Jeff? And that motion is from Jeff, and it was seconded by...
Kirk.
Thank you. Everybody in favor? Okay. And opposed? I can't see everybody, sorry. So that was unanimous. Thank you. And then do we have another motion?
And then also, is there a way you can put a provision in there on livestock protection?
We went around and around on that, and it's tough to do that without... The problem is the officer doesn't know who set that set. And if there's a number on it that goes back to you, then he knows who that set is. But you're right, it changes things a little bit.
Is there a way that the rancher can just go into the office and get a tag without having to pay the money? I mean, to...
We didn't discuss that, but, you know, that's obviously something you guys could recommend if you want to try that.
That is just a one-time deal.
Yeah,
I understand it, but I also
understand... They have to have a fur bearer's permit, correct?
Right.
I also understand the ranchers in this part of the world that are just trying to protect their livestock.
That
$10, as little as it sounds, is going to be heartburn for people.
Yeah, I understand. I'm sympathetic to that. This is one of those things where how do you split the baby? You got to...
Yeah, understandable.
Somewhere, yeah.
Just bringing up a point.
Yeah, sure.
So do we have a motion on the remainder of the proposal?
I'll make a motion to approve the forbear rule amendments with what was stated with increasing it to 600 feet.
Okay, so we have a motion by Todd Thorne.
I'll second.
Okay, and seconded by Keith.
Point of discussion, Chair. With regard to livestock owners protecting their animals, would we be able to amend your motion, Todd, to change the wording to where livestock owners that can prove ownership of their livestock can be exempted from the $10 rule on their own property?
Yeah, I can. I'll amend my motion to change that language to where you can prove ownership of livestock that you can possibly or waive that $10 fee. So we
can, are you clear? This is on private property, not permitted property, and that you're saying private property.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just trapping on your own place, because a lot of livestock owners will bring their livestock in for calving and lambing and stuff onto their own place.
I think that's going to go over. It'll go over a lot better, I believe.
You know, it's just kind of an idea I had to work to find the middle ground where, you know, it doesn't put as much hardship on an old rancher that doesn't even know this discussion's taking place.
Yeah. No,
and he could end up in violation of the law up on his own place, you know, around his pens and stuff where he's setting traps for coyotes because he's bringing in his calves and everything, and that's going to attract coyotes. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
but
I don't know how we would want to word that exactly.
Right. And then to clarify, from your position, we can waive the fee, but they still would be given a number that they then have to put on their traps.
Right, they'd still have to comply. I think, you know, if that's what the RAC decides to do, our assistant AG can figure out the wording that would work there. So,
so I will make a motion to approve the forbear rule amendments with the exempting livestock owners from a $10 registration fee on their private property.
I'll second that.
So Todd made a motion and a seconded by Jeff. All in favor? Okay, opposed. All right, so it's unanimous.
Okay, moving right along. So my next agenda item is the Bobcat Fur Bear permit recommendations for this upcoming season. I wanted to do a quick reminder for everyone on how we manage bobcats in the state. We do have a management plan for bobcats in Utah, and we set three management criteria that we look at while we're collecting data on bobcat harvest in the state. The first is the number of juveniles that we see in the harvest. We have a target window between 42 and 56% in the harvest. This is an indicator of reproduction. People, when you trap, tend to catch what's out there in the densities that they occur. If it's higher than 56%, that's okay. That just indicates there's more juveniles in the population. But if it's lower than that, we would then, in combination with another one of our criteria here, make changes to the regulations. Having said that, here's a graph of that data since 2000. The blue line represents the percent of juveniles in the harvest. The red dotted dashed line is the lower end of that target window. Again, remember, we want it to be above that line. And you can see the last 4 years we have been there. So we're within the management plan parameters for that particular target. The second target we shoot for is adult survival. We want adult survival to be between 65 and 72%. If it's higher than that, again, that's okay. We wouldn't recommend any changes to tags or season lengths. If it's below that, we would want to look at changes. So here is the graph of that data. Really quickly, that just because of the way the graphics work out, that last data point is actually right at 65%. It looks like it might be a little bit below that. So it's within the window. We don't want it to be below that. But since it's at the lower end, we're still in compliance with the plan. Again, if it drops below that, then we'd want to take a look at things. The third management criteria is the percent females in the harvest. We want that to be between 41 and 45%. In this case, we want it to be lower. If it's lower than that, it's okay. If it's higher than that, we're probably harvesting too many of our reproductive animals, and we want to make changes to try to lower that number. And here's the graph on that. So this one, I actually have the red lines represent that target window. You can see that we're trending in the right direction over the last 3 years at least, and so again we're in compliance. This is another one of these weird graphic things. That last point actually is on the line at 41%, so even though it looks like it's below it, but again it's going the right way. We want to have lower females in the harvest. So just quickly, this is the last 3 years of data and the management ranges on the right hand side. All of those parameters are within our management targets. What would happen is if we had a couple of those outside going in the wrong direction, then we would reduce the number of permits a person could have and shorten the season to try to get those to come back. But since we're within the windows, we're not going to recommend any changes this year. A couple other things that came up in the past that I thought would be good to show you folks is we changed management strategy a couple of years ago to allow people to buy up to 6 permits and didn't have a cap on the number of total permits that could be sold. And we also we lengthened the seasons. And what we saw is a really a big jump. So the blue line is the number of permits sold. The yellow line is the number of permit buyers. That first year after we made changes, and people have kind of figured out the system, and it looks like they're kind of trending down. They either got out there and it wasn't quite what they bargained for, or they figured out they didn't need to have quite so many permits in their pocket, that kind of thing. So we think we're going to probably get back to, you know, just sort of the average range on that. At least that's where we seem to be going. The other thing that's interesting to note is that one of the biggest drivers in bobcat harvest are the pelt price. And so it tends to cycle. The blue line there is the number of people a field. The yellow line is what the pelt price has done over the last 17 years. You can see it, pelt price goes up, hunters go up. Pelt price goes down, hunters go down, which is fairly intuitive, I would think. So finally, these are our recommendations for this coming season. 6 tags per individual. The season would be November 15th through March 1st, 2018, and no cap on the number of permits sold. And then we'll keep an eye on our management parameters, make adjustments if we need to moving forward. The other fur bearer season dates that we're recommending for beaver and mink, September 23rd through April 4th, 2018, and then all the other fur-bearing species, marten, badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel would be September 23rd through March 1st. That's it.
Do we have any questions for Darren? Are there any questions from the audience?
Darren, is there any data out there that indicates that bobcats are plentiful, that
trappers are releasing juveniles and maybe females, and this skewing the data?
It looks like we're probably skewed towards males. We usually run about 1.7 males per female, which you'd expect to be 50-50. And so that's something that we definitely want to look at. And actually, you know, with that female parameter, we'd like to see trappers do that. The other thing to bear in mind is that we've advanced that season later and later into February, and we'd expect to see more males as you get late, as that breeding season starts, those males start ranging. And so, yeah, those are all things that we need to keep in mind while we're looking at it.
Plus the price differential between
right.
males.
Yeah, they're more valuable usually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Darris, I can comment to that a little bit. I've got a couple of friends that trap, and I know what they do and the people they trap with and talk to in terms of the trappers. They release every female they catch, because they understand that they like trapping bobcats, and if you trap all the females, you're not going to have bobcats to trap. So that's their attitude. It's anecdotal, but that is the attitude of some people I know that are doing it.
Any additional comments from the audience? Questions, sorry. Do we have any comment cards from the audience?
No comment cards that I have.
So coming back to the rack, knee.
Make a motion that we accept the bobcat recommendations as presented.
Okay, so we have a motion by Eric Luke, seconded by Daryl Meekum. All in favor? Great. Unanimous. You're up again. Cat man.
All right. So maintaining the cat theme, these are our mountain lion recommendations for this upcoming season. I just want to again do a quick refresher on how we manage lions in the state. We do have a mountain lion plan that we follow. There are three harvest seasons setups that we use, and then we have an additional pursuit season where people can pursue lions but then don't take the lion at the end of the chase. So those are, the first is limited entry, and that's just like with big game, you have a certain number of tags that are available. People can draw those tags through the draw if they harvest or don't harvest. Then whatever's harvested at the end of the season is what is taken off the unit. The second hunt strategy is a split unit. So this is limited entry for a certain period of time. Say you have 10 permits. If you harvest 8 lions out of that during that time frame, and there are 2 left, that the unit would then turn to harvest objective, and those 2 remaining permits would then become a quota. And once those 2 tags were filled, the season would close for that unit. If they didn't fill those and the season ends, then it would you'd be done. The third is a harvest objective unit. This is just a straight quota. So those 10 permits would be a quota rather than a number of permits that would be available. And so anybody could buy harvest objective permit, hunt that unit. Once the 10 animals are taken, then the season ends. The unit closes. And then how we manage, similar to bobcats, we have some targets that we're shooting for with lions. The first and probably most critical is the percent of females in the harvest, similar to bobcats. We want that to be less than 40%. And then the percent of adults in the harvest, we want to be between, so this is 5 years and older. We want to be between 15 and 20%. The only caveat to that is that we do have certain units where we're concerned about prey bases, deer or bighorn sheep, for example. In those units where we have concerns that lions might be affecting those prey species, we may go outside of these targets in order to try to reduce lion numbers overall. And you'll see some examples of that in the individual unit recommendations. The other thing that we look at are concerned with are livestock depredation problems. And so, you know, if we've got chronic problems or even, you know, occasional problems, we want to deal with those, make sure that we get the animal that's causing the problem out of there. And we may make permit adjustments based on that. If we've got a unit that has chronic problems, we may try to reduce the lion population on that unit. So here's a graph from 1990 to present of our historical hunter harvest for lions. So on the left is the number of animals taken per year. Obviously, the bottom is the years. The green line are the total number of animals taken since 1990 per year. The blue and pink lines, for no particular reason, are male and females in the harvest. That's just how it breaks down. So a couple things to point out. One is that in the mid-90s and late 90s, we got really aggressive with lion permits in the state. You see that big sweeping uptick. As a result of that, we wrote our first cougar management plan in 1999. We had some concerns and wanted to have some kind of... So we got a committee together of diverse interests and wrote a plan. You can see that since then, things have kind of stabilized a little bit, which is kind of the intent. And we have revised the plan a couple of times since then. The other thing I wanted to point out is just the last several years, you can see that harvest is increasing. That's probably both due to the fact that we have increased permits during that time frame. I think it also has a lot to do with our mule deer population. Prey base goes up, predator base goes up. The other thing is that most of that increased harvest has been with male cats. If you look at that blue line, you can see that that's increased, and the female harvest has remained fairly steady over that last 4 years or so. This graphic shows the percent of males and females in the harvest. The dotted black line is our target. We want female harvest, which is the salmon, I guess, colored part, to be below 40%. So since about 2008, we've been there statewide. Again, this is statewide, and it'll vary by unit, but on a statewide basis, looking at cougar populations, we're where the plan suggests we need to be. This is the other parameter, the percent of five years old and older in the harvest. You can see this jumps around quite a bit. There's a lot of, you know, variance, and, you know, you got units with small numbers of tags and that kind of thing. So you will see it bounce, but it is trending up. So we are seeing more older animals in the harvest consistently over the last few years. It means that we consistently seem to have older age classes statewide within the population. This is a similar graph, except that this is all age classes. So this is the entire harvest, and this is just our average age of males. You can see that seems to be trending up since 2000. We're seeing older age males in the harvest. And here's the graph for females. There isn't quite as strong of a relationship there. You could probably argue that that's not a real trend, but if anything, it's stable over time. And, you know, around 3.2, something like that. This is a graph of livestock depredation represented over the last several years. And so the green line there are the number of incidences. So when a landowner or a livestock producer calls us and we... or calls Wildlife Services, and they go investigate, we call that an incident. And then the orange line are the number of animals that have been, lions that have been removed as a result of those reported incidences. The concerning thing here is that we seem to be on an upswing. That correlates with, again, probably more lions in the population. And so that's concerning to us, and some of our recommendations tonight will reflect some adjustments for that. So moving on to unit by unit recommendations, I thought in the interest of time, maybe I'd just highlight where things are changing, but obviously if you have questions about other units, we can hit those. So these are the recommendations for the northern region. On the left-hand side is the unit name. There's a category there that's considered for predator management. So I mentioned before, if we've got concerns with prey species, they'll be listed there. So it may say deer, it may say BHS, which is bighorn sheep. And I have a small correction in this on the manti I'll point out as we get there. And then permits last year, and then permits recommended for this year. Finally, on the right-hand side is the harvest strategy that I mentioned at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So Box Elder Raft River, we're recommending an increase of 2 permits. On the cache, it's a harvest objective unit, we're recommending an increase of 3. Chalk Creek Camas, an increase of 2. East Canyon, an increase of 2. Oregon South Ridge, an increase of 4. Moving to the northeastern region, here's the predator management column comes into play. So Buckcliffs East, they have concerns about deer numbers. They've got quite a number of permits, but they're not recommending any change to those numbers, probably because they feel like they're getting the harvest they need. Again, with these other two, no changes. The South Slope Vernal Bonanza, Diamond Mountain increasing 2 permits recommended. Wasatch Mountains, Current Creek North, an increase of 2. The Central Mountains, Nebo West Face increased 2. Central Mountains, Southwest Manti increased 2. Just back to the manti. It says there's no consideration for predator management. All of the manti units should say deer on that. That was an oversight on my part. I just missed it. And I hadn't had a chance to change it. Oker Stansberries, an increase of 1. And then no changes on those Wasatch units. This Wasatch Mountains, I might like wreaking havoc with your recording system. So I'm like, anyway, Wasatch Mountains, Salt Lake County East is a new unit. Let me show you a map of that area. So this is the area east of Salt Lake City from I-80 south to Draper, and then over to Park City and Parley Summit. This is within Salt Lake County. Discharge of firearms is not allowed. Hunting with dogs is not allowed. So it's really tough to address populations of lions in that area. So the region is going to try something, and that is to put a quota of 6 up there, but it's going to be an archery-only hunt just because of Salt Lake County's restrictions. So we don't expect a lot of lions to be taken, but it is, you know, we'll see if, you know, it's also the extended archery season for mule deer. And the idea is if they're out there with a bow hunting deer and they've got a lion tag in their pocket and they see a lion, big if, that maybe they could take the lion. So that was their thinking. Again, we don't have any illusions about how effective that might be. And then the West Desert Tintic Vernon, they'd like to increase by 3. Moving to the southern region, the beaver unit, increase of 1. Wilmore Pavant, increase of 3. And then this unlimited category, so this is the Kaparowitz. These are units, and you'll see some in this region too, that they're remote, they're rugged, they're tough to get into. We usually, if we're lucky, get one lion on an unlimited season. And so there's no reason to have a limit on the quota. You're just not ever going to get that kind of pressure, but it is in place to try to address bighorn sheep herds and especially lions that may be targeting those animals where they don't have a lot of their prey options. The Mount Dutton increased by 1, recommended. Pine Valley North and South, 2 and 1 respectively. the Southwest Desert an increase of 2, and the Zion an increase of 2. And one change here, too, is the Plateau Thousand Lakes was a split unit. They'd like to make that just a harvest objective, a quota, straight quota unit. Moving on to the southeastern region. So Book Cliffs, Rattlesnake, that's an unlimited unit for the same reason we mentioned before. The Central Mountain Southeast Manti increased by 4. And that should say yes for deer. Right, guys? Okay. 9 Mile North, an increase of 3. No changes to these units. Okay. So this graphic just shows the percentages of limited entry hunt opportunities compared to the harvest objective or quota units over time, over the last 4 years. I just put this up there. People sometimes want to know, you know, how is this changing over time? So we are heavier on the harvest objective permits. This is total permits across the state. So it's not by individual hunts. These are our season date recommendations. So limited entry season would be November 8th through May 31st. Split units would be November 8th through February 25th. And then any remaining permits would go into a harvest objective quota and run from March 1st through May 31st. Harvest objective units are essentially year-round. There's a little bit of window, but November 8th, 2017 through November 2018, or until the quota's filled. And then those unlimited units literally do run year-round. They don't ever close. And finally, pursuit season would be November 8th through May 31st. That's all I have.
Do we have questions from the RAC?
Yeah. I'm on that new unit in Salt Lake County. I know, you know, within incorporated areas of the county, they prohibit the discharge of firearms, but right. That, I mean, that's a redundancy because state law already covers how
right,
that
yeah.
works.
Yeah.
But I have a question. Does the state allow the counties to set their own hunting regulations now?
Counties can set the discharge of firearms.
Yeah, I understand that.
But not hunting. They cannot regulate hunting.
They don't allow hunting with dogs in Salt Lake County.
That was my understanding from the region, that for some reason they...
Does the state allow the counties to set their own regulations?
I don't think counties... My understanding is that counties don't have the authority to regulate hunting. And so, you know, I wish I knew more details on exactly what was, but that's been my understanding is that there's a restriction on dogs, and I don't know if it's something the county set or it's because of the nature of the cabin associations and things like that are up there. I could find out more on that, but I don't know exactly.
I'm curious about that. If you could find
but
out,
as a matter of law,
on it or something, that
right? Only the Division of Wildlife can regulate hunting, and counties can't. They can't close an area to hunting. They can close it to the discharge of a firearm or bow or an air rifle, but they can't close it to hunting.
I know the state code lets the county
whether they
do
could
that.
They could have a leash law which would prohibit. It could be something like that. You know, you just can't have dogs running off leash. That it could be something like that, and they would be able to do something like that.
From my understanding, in my day job, I'm a Carbon County planner. From my understanding, if it's Forest Service, the county can't necessarily put in a limitation of what, if it's Forest Service property. If it's private property, the counties can, you know, create ordinances or things through their development code and zoning regulations. But I think most of that's national forest.
And it may be a forest regulation.
So
and those trails in Alta and all those trails.
Counties really don't have jurisdiction to say you can't do this on the Forest Service land. Forest Service can set their own regulations, but be able to have a county to say, you know, on national forest land, you can't run dogs. I've never... I've never come across that, you know, and we've, as a county, there's some things that we disagree with what the Forest Service does, but ultimately, when the Forest Service makes a decision, whether we like it as a county or not, has to abide by it because it's a federal land agency. So that is interesting that if they can do that, that's, I've never really never heard of that.
The region just told me that you weren't allowed to hunt with dogs, and so I should have dug a little bit and figured out why. But I will. I'll look.
I know.
An email on that, so we.
Yeah, I can do that. I'll report back to the RAC on that. Sure.
I know many of those watersheds are closed to dogs and stuff, and so that's maybe what.
I think that's what
the
is.
Limit is. They don't let you just run dogs around because of the watershed water, drinking water.
If it's a Forest Service regulation or something, then...
Now that you mention that, Darren, I'm pretty sure that's why.
Yeah, I can see it being a Forest Service.
You
got to
pick up after your dogs, and you can't have them off.
That's interesting because I hunted up there last year, and every one of those trails that I went up, there were people walking, and trails were just covered with dog tracks that were on a leash, probably, most of them, but...
I think if you're on a leash and you carry a little plastic bag and pick up after them, you're okay. But
is there any other form of management in that area?
It makes it tough. If we want to try to address things, the division has, you know, if we have a particular concern, obviously we've got authority to do things. But we like to afford opportunities to sportsmen whenever we can. So we'll kind of see how this goes. Obviously, if we had a lion that we were concerned about, you know, that it stalked someone or took off after someone up there, then we'd deal with that ourselves. Yeah.
So they, even on the Forest Service that's unincorporated, they don't allow firearms in Salt Lake County?
Right. That's my understanding. And I think it's just because of the volume
use. The Forest Service doing that, or is that Salt Lake County?
I can find out for you. They said it was
Salt
the county.
Lake County, we need to put a stop to it.
Yeah, they said it was the county.
Yeah, I don't think that's Forest Service. I think that's county.
And it may be because of the volume of use on those trails. They don't want people up there shooting. And the county can regulate shooting. They can't regulate hunting. But I'll look into that too, just to make sure. Just I think we're on the right track as far as what's going on. But I'll double check and let you guys know.
I'm curious, just questions about that now.
I have a question on the Southwest Manti. Since the Manti falls under a predator management for the deer, that changes the management plan. As I understand it, and rather than a harvest of less than 40, they want a harvest of over 40%.
Can be more. The way the plan is worded is, and the qualifications are, it needs to be below 80% of the mule deer objective. If we're talking about deer, adult survival needs to regularly fall below, I think, 85% survival. So there are these triggers, and then the plan says you may harvest more and get outside of these targets. So it does leave it up to the region and biologist to make a call. In other words, it's not mandatory, and if they don't feel like, for example, if you've got a low cougar harvest, you're only taking 3 or 4 animals a year, and you're outside of your parameters, or you're inside, it doesn't really mean much, it's all too low of a sample size, or they may feel like they've got habitat issues or something like that. So anyway, there's flexibility in the plan, Eric, at least that's how I interpret it.
Okay, I guess I looked at it a little differently, because to me it says portion of female harvest. Well, I got to refine it, make sure.
It's kind of confusing, but if you look at the remedies, so if you look at deer, there'll be some strategies, and I could be wrong, because I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I think it says you may increase harvest on those units,
And so, and in, on this one specifically, so this is one that's shared between regions, and the central region is managing it at a much lower harvest rate than the southeastern region, right? I talked to the central region manager about that. The history on that is that, you know, over the years they've tried to increase permits on that unit, and it's died through the process. And so they're willing to take a look at it again and get with the region here and maybe look at more of a combined strategy for those units. But right now they, you know, the recommendations are how they came in. So
I do have a recommendation of two permits. I guess my question was, with me having the understanding that the objective, because it was predator management, was to have a harvest of over 40% of females. Right. And my question would be, is an increase of two permits enough to do that? Because they're well below that.
Depends on
now
what kind of animal they take. But right now, yeah, they're managing under a split. Or no, it's limited entry on this.
Right, limited entry.
And again, that in large part is due to the public process. But you know, I can commit that we as biologists can sit down and take a look at that and see what makes sense and what the concerns are. So. And obviously the RAC can recommend a change right now if you want to.
Another quick question. Can you explain to me that on the Central Mountains, what's north, south versus east, west? Is there an easy split there?
Maybe. Can one of you guys explain that?
The short version is Huntington Canyon and Scott.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, they just need to get out with them and learn the country. Spent my time in the northern region.
This is maybe a question for you, but maybe Daryl too. I mean, you're stating that you're taking older males, more males. Is that because we believe that that's the population, or is that trophy hunting? Meaning, are we letting lions go that aren't big and males? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so lion hunting by its nature is selective. Obviously, so if you're using dogs, you get to look at the animal in the tree. So harvest is skewed. What we're trying to get at with that age of harvest is there's a lot of recent research that's been going on in sort of social structure among lions. If you can have older animals in your population and you don't have other concerns that you're trying to address, you may actually have lower densities. You get a big male, he'll set up a big territory, and he kicks everything out, especially the young males that come in. A lot of times those teenagers are the ones that cause problems. And so when they wrote and readdressed the plan, they wanted to allow for that, to try and keep older age classes as long as there aren't livestock problems or problems with other things. But it is skewed.
When there is a problem with livestock, is there some sort of depredation pool where sportsmen can, you know, put their name in a hat, and so if something comes up, a houndsman or just a general sportsman?
Sorry, I didn't mean to step
in. Yeah, I could help out.
Yeah, we do have a lot of tools in place, so that would be an option if you've got a line. Normally, the normal process is the livestock producer will call his wildlife service, his government trapper, his agent, and they'll... I'll try to address the problem, but the plan does say, you know, you could try. It's kind of a timing thing, you know. If he's having sheep killed, he doesn't want to wait a couple of days for us to come up with a hunter. But if we can, we'll do that, and we have the option to do that. Another tool that we have is if a livestock producer is having chronic problems, we'll give them tags to handle the problem proactively. So if they know I'm taking lambs up here, I got a lion in that's hitting me every year, they can go in ahead of time with these tags and try to take that lion. And those tags, they can't keep the lion, so it's not something they could sell, but we're pretty flexible about who they, you know, if they know a houndsman that they want to have go take care of the problem, they can give the tag to that person.
Is it, if I understand it right, if a
livestockman or one of their herders actually encounters a lion in their herd, they can shoot it on sight. Is that correct?
If it's chasing, harassing, looking sideways at,
yeah.
They can take it.
All right. Are there any questions from the audience?
On your management objectives, triggers or whatever that determine whether you increase tags or decrease tags, was that just sport harvest, or was the depredation animals included in that?
It's mainly targeted towards sport harvest. When we start getting into depredation, a lot of times that's on a second trail. You mean the numbers? Yeah, the numbers is sport harvest. I probably should have done a better job of kind of teasing that out, Darris. It's some of those charts are all take, and others are sport harvest. And so there's a little, yeah.
I just noticed that we're right on the line on a couple of those. And if you added depredation harvest in, does that do anything to your triggers?
It could. So the tables include everything. And so when we look at the targets, we'd be looking at that with kind of everything lumped together. But one of the goals was to try to decrease depredation take and increase hunter take on those units where we've got issues, and so we've been trying to manage that direction.
Any other questions from the audience? Chris, do we have a comment card?
Do you have a comment card? Greg Guyman.
Okay.
I'm Brett Guyman. I'm representing Farron Houndsman, guys, if that gives me 5 minutes. I've got a handout. Is that okay if I... So what I've just passed out is... the data that you saw earlier in the presentation was statewide data. This is data specific to the central or the Manti Deer Management Unit, which encompasses four lion units: Northeast Manti, Southeast Manti, Northwest Manti, and Southwest Manti. What I did, the blue line is the deer projections, or not projections, the deer estimates. Since 2004, you'll notice I scribbled out 2002, 2003. The reason is I made an error when I compiled that data. In 2002 and 2003, there was no northeast, northwest. It was north Manti, south Manti. So that's where that error came from. So if you look at 2004 on, that's the correct data to look at. But I think a lot of times we manage lions based on deer. I don't think we're supposed to, but that's what we end up doing when we adjust tag numbers. And if you look at this and look at the trend line, my intent in bringing this up is to try to maybe open a few eyes and let people see that deer population certainly doesn't independently depend on the number of lion tags and the lion harvest that you have in any given year. In fact, if you were to read this graph independent of any other factor, you would say that decreasing a lion harvest actually increases, decreasing a lion harvest actually increases the deer herd, if you follow the trend line there. I'm not advocating that we not manage lions based on the deer population. I've got kind of two items for consideration. The first is the number of permits on the Southeast Manti. 3 years ago, the number of permits was at 10. The recommendation this year is 20. That's a 100% increase over 3 years. The Southwest Manti has maintained, it used to be, you know, upwards of 16 tags. It's now down to 8. They're recommending a 2-tag increase this year. They're meeting the same indicators on the management plan as is the Southeast Manti. because it's in the same deer management unit. So what I'd like to see is a reduction in the number of tags on the southeast manti by two. That still gives you a two tag increase, and it takes it down to around 80% on the percentage increase over 3 years. So you're still getting an 80% increase on the total number of tags over 3 years. And then the second piece of that, so just FYI, there's, again, 20 tags on the southeast manti, 8 tags on the southwest manti. If you're familiar with those areas, I'm not 100% sure where that discrepancy comes from, why the tag, well, I have my own ideas on why that happened, but I think we need to increase them maybe on the southwest manti and decrease them on the southeast manti. Part of that comes from we haven't met the southeast manti is in a split strategy. We haven't, in the last 2 years, we haven't met that quota, and we're still increasing tags by four. Southwest manti is a limited entry, and yet we're in predator management for the entire manti. So that brings me to my second point, and that is any deer management unit that is under predator management, it doesn't make sense to me why you would have a limited entry unit on that deer unit. So I would ask you to consider turning the southwest manti into a split harvest strategy from its current strategy of limited entry. I think that's all I've got.
Thank you.
Brett? Yeah. Will you... I got your second one. What was your first recommendation?
First recommendation would be to decrease the number of proposed permits on the southeast manti by two.
Southeast. An increase of two.
And increase the two on. So you're just shifting the two from the southeast manti to the southwest manti.
So are you asking for?
Four total on the southwest.
Four total on southwest. Okay.
Okay, so do we have additional comments from the RAC or a motion?
I have a comment. I actually like the thought of what Brett has proposed. As I look at the numbers here, the Southwest Manti being limited entry for their three-year time frame has only killed about 66% of the total permits. I agree that with the manti being in a predator management system, I'm not sure that I would agree with that strategy. I like the idea of a split season. It allows for the those extra tags to be filled. That's all I have. I just think that.
Would you like to make a motion?
I don't think we have more comments.
Yeah, I could spend an hour. You know me, the guys that have been here. Your units like the LaSalle's and the Henry's that have an artificially high number, even though it's your predatory unit, is, I believe, just something for your statistical numbers. I mean, LaSalle's gets hunted as hard as hell. And you have four lines taken, but it's got 15 on it. So that makes your charts and stuff look real pretty, makes your take look good, makes your numbers look good. And you're right, biologically, if you have a stable population where you have a large lion in the area, you have fewer lions. So when you have this game of killing as many as you can, you have teenagers and a population trying to spread and go, so it's a wreck. But I'll get into this probably more. When's the plan change next time? When's it up?
Probably another 10 years, but it can be reviewed anytime. They just did it last year.
So I see no reason why you even play the game of having like the LaSalle's and the Henry's in any kind of unit other than unlimited. Open it up, because that's basically what you have, other than to make your numbers look good.
And I mean, these numbers are just putting everything together statewide.
Exactly.
Any other? Go ahead. Any other?
I'd make a motion that we, how do I word this? That we, on the south, or on the Manti, on the southwest Manti, we would ask for that shift of tags so that there's an increase of 4 tags on the southwest Manti, and also that that unit be changed to a split season unit, and that the southeast Manti only have an increase of 2 tags rather than 4 tags. And the rest of the recommendation would be accepted.
I'll second that.
Okay. So we have a recommendation that on the southwest Manti, we're going to recommend a split harvest strategy, increasing the southwest by 4 and increasing the southeast by 4. Right, 2. I'm sorry, 2. I wrote reduction in. And we have that by Eric and seconded by, one more time, Jace.
Did you mention split season in your?
Yes.
Yes, she did.
Okay. So, everybody in favor? Oh, go ahead.
Question. So, I'm not opposing or any. I'm just asking a question. So that would make you still have a limited entry on the northwest, right? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, under the current recommendation, yeah.
Yeah. This is just manipulating the southwest Manti.
I guess, I don't know if that makes sense or if that's still, but.
Northwest Manti is also limited entry.
Right.
Can I change my motion? Let me look at the harvest data on that one. That basically the same results there. So I would change my motion to include the northwest Manti to also be recommended as a split season unit.
I mean, would that just make all of the central mountains, the entire Manti split? That chunk, is
you
that correct?
Do two motions. Do the split in one and then your adjustment on the second one.
That sounds great. Okay, so let's start with just hunt strategies.
Okay, then I would make a motion that because of the predator management situation that the Manti is in, I would recommend that the northwest and southwest Manti units be changed to a split season unit.
Do I have a second on that?
Second.
We actually have to vote on the motion on the table before we can make another motion. It's getting a little...
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I'm doing the hunt strategy.
Yeah.
I think he's amending.
He withdrew it, right? Mm-hmm. He withdrew the original motion, so it's not on the table anymore?
Yeah.
Say that again.
Did you withdraw your original motion, so it's not on the table?
Yes.
Okay.
Withdraw the original motion.
Okay.
And we'll split that into 2 separate motions.
Okay. Okay, so Eric has made a motion to turn the southwest and northwest hunt strategies into a split. It was seconded by Jace. All in favor?
Need a second.
It was seconded by Jace. Sorry. All in favor? And that's unanimous. Approved. Okay. So, second motion.
Okay, now I would make a motion that the number of tags on the southwest be increased by a total of 4, and the number of tags on the southeast only be raised by 2.
Okay, so we have a motion from Eric to increase the southeast manti by 2 and increase the southwest by 4. Do I have a second on that motion?
Second.
Okay, Jay seconds that motion. All in favor? Okay, so do I have to name all those, Chris, or can I just do the ones that are opposed? Do I have to name them all? Okay, so all opposed? So opposed, we have Daryl Meekum and Sue Bellagamba. And Kent. Thank you.
So just so I'm clear, that should make the permit recommendations for the southwest 12, correct? It was 10. We're increasing it by 4. No, it was, the recommendation was 10, but you wanted to go 4 yes. from last year, yes. so there'd be an additional.
The recommendation would be for 12 permits.
That'd be 12, and then 18
on the south.
The southeast.
Correct.
Okay. Just want to make sure I got it right here. Thanks.
And that passed. Thank you. And then lastly, do we have a motion on the remainder of the recommendations by the division?
I'll make a motion. We accept the remainder of the recommendations as presented.
Okay. So Eric wants to accept the remainder of the motion as presented. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Jay seconds it. All in favor? Okay. All opposed? So we have Daryl and Sue opposing, and it does pass. On to beaver management.
All right, this is the last thing I have. So the division has a beaver management plan, and this plan is up for review. Actually, the plan was implemented in 2010, and it calls for a five-year review, so we're actually a little bit late on that review. But we did begin looking at it in 2016, and we used an internal committee. The beaver plan is not one that's required in statute, but it is something that we do just try to make sure we're maintaining that population. So we got together Habitat, Aquatics, and Wildlife sections internally, and we also consulted with some outside consultants, some professors from USU and some the Trappers Association and some other folks. Here are the results of that review. First of all, a lot of the objectives in the original plan had been reached, and so we wanted to acknowledge that and then maybe try to move a little bit further down the line. One of those goals that was spelled out or introduced in the original plan was to develop a model that identified suitability of beaver habitat throughout the state. That model is they named the Beaver Reintroduction Assessment Tool, or BRAT. It actually does more than just assess reintroduction. What it does, it looks at habitat types, woody vegetation. It tries to determine if areas within the state are suitable for beavers. And then finally, we wanted to encourage as much as possible the use of beavers to restore suitable riparian systems throughout the state where they'd been extirpated or removed. So let me just describe a little bit about what this model does and how it works. First of all, as I mentioned, it assesses habitat types. It can determine if a site doesn't have beavers in it, whether it'd be suitable to try to use beavers to rehab an area. It has a very conservative model that looks at the likelihood of human conflict, and by conservative I mean it overestimates, if anything, the likelihood of human problems. So if the habitat's close to a road or a trail, or it's on private property, or those kind of things, it'll be flagged, and then we can make sure we look further into that. What it does also is it identifies that if transplant sites, if we're considering an area, it needs to score well in the model in order to be considered. So it helps us to assess where we might want to make changes or make recommendations for habitat. So what it is the model is a GIS model. GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems, and it uses satellite data primarily to look at these different parameters on the landscape. And it just helps us manipulate in time and space the data that you know, you put data in a table or you can make a map of it. And the map is usually a lot more user-friendly and a little bit easier to interpret. And so let me show you some results. So this is the output for the Spawn Creek drainage, which is up just east of Logan in the northern part of the state, Temple Fork, that area up in there. And the colors correspond to the suitability of the habitat within the drainage. There's a legend up at the top. I wouldn't get super hung up on that. I can obviously explain it in more detail if you want to. Green and blue is generally good habitat. Orange is an initial pass that identifies some possible human conflict. And then if it's red, you can see up in that upper sort of middle part of the map, there's a red section there. That just is naturally limited. So I think in there it's probably steep sides and the river's too steep for a beaver to build a dam there. So there's no point. That tells us there's no point even looking at that. But there may be some other areas that are suitable. Now on top of this, even though we have human conflict identified, we do an additional layer for human conflict by itself. And you'll see that those red areas overlay on that. So what that does is it flags it for us. So there may have been some of those areas that we thought, you know, this would be, we don't have beavers here, but we have good habitat. Oh, but we might have a human conflict here. In this case, I think there's a trail that runs up there. You can see the roads on that bottom part. That doesn't totally kick it out, but it does mean that we need to go in on the ground and look at that. And you know, if the roads are high enough above it that it doesn't cause a risk, or the drainage is long enough and we don't feel like there's a problem, we may be able to move forward. But we do need to consult with the land management agency. In this case, it would be the Forest Service. If it's private land, obviously private landers, those kinds of things. And a plan would need to be put together to address, you know, is there going to be human conflict? If there is, what will we do about it? Those kinds of things. Some people ask in the process here, why would we want to move beavers around anyway? Chris mentioned before, in some cases we build these analogs, these beaver dams that we make to try to achieve some of these same goals. The advantage here is that you have a critter that does it for you, and as long as they're not causing problems, that's sometimes a really cost-effective way to accomplish some things. So beaver dam building typically will raise your water table in a drainage. It can eliminate your cut banks, and the way it does that is, you know, as they build dams within the stream and you get silt buildup, you know, those cut banks will slowly fill in. And as they fill in, it reconnects the stream with its floodplain, so you start to get more of a wet meadow kind of system. That can benefit livestock and big game grazing along those corridors. You might have, right now you have a cut bank and you've got sagebrush. You know, if you can get that wet meadow system back, you can provide a little bit extra grazing and water. It provides more diverse suite of species in those habitats. And it can also help with silt retention, and then it can slow runoff. So in the spring, it's not like flushing the toilet and scouring everything out. It slows down that water flow as it comes through the system, and can help to maintain those areas and help with flood control. So those are reasons why we might want to consider that. The other thing the plan does is require quarantine, or certain things that we have to do if we're going to take a beaver from one place and move it to another. The first is, if beavers are in waters that we know contain aquatic invasive species like whirling disease, or you know, there's a whole suite of things that aquatics folks are concerned about. we know it's from one of those waters, it can't be placed anywhere but into another water that's already got those parasites or things in it. Anyway, in other words, you're not contaminating one with the other. So it does allow that. The second situation would be a clean system. If you can take beavers from a clean system and move them wherever else you want to. And finally, if there's some question or we're not sure about the status of the water, it requires a 72-hour quarantine before they can be released. And so this is actually a picture from our southern region quarantine facility that they've built down there. So we'll put them in there. We'll hold them. There are some procedures to try to wash the fur. It allows them to pass stuff through their systems and kind of cleans them out. We don't use a hot sprayer or anything like that, but a power washer or whatever. But we do give them a chance, and then our vet will take a look, and she assesses them and makes sure that they're good to go. So we won't just be parachuting beavers in everywhere across the state, I guess, is the take home. So just quickly in summary, the changes to the plan are that we're using this model to assess habitat suitability, and then if we want to try to do some work habitat-wise. We really want to make sure we're avoiding potential conflicts, and we require a management plan to deal with areas where we feel like there may be some conflicts. We do have private landowners that would like to do this, but we need to make sure their neighbors are on board and all of those things. It allows us to move beavers a little bit more easily through the state. The old plan identified 4 different subspecies. I went through the literature and looked, and that's pretty shaky. The overwhelming consensus seems to be that North American beavers are North American beavers pretty much throughout the country, and so we didn't need to put those kind of restrictions on. And then finally, the quarantine is required. And that's it.
Do we have any questions from the RAC?
What are the human conflicts? I mean, they're not grizzly bears. It's kind of...
Damming irrigation ditches, damming culverts along highways, flooding highways, those kinds of things. Highways and trails and roads. And they can be a headache if they're not in the right
place.
That
makes sense. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah, they don't usually attack people.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of them. They ran right away.
That's right, yeah.
Additional questions? Okay, questions from the audience? Have any comments? Okay. So coming back to the RAC, do we have a motion?
Motion to accept the beaver management plan as presented by the division.
Okay, we have a motion from Kent Green to accept the beaver management plan as proposed. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, seconded by Keith. All in favor? And it's unanimous. Passed. Thanks,
everybody, I appreciate your time. That was a marathon.
Okay, I'm Justin Hart. I'm the aquatics manager. I've been a biologist and a manager in the southeast region for about 15 years now. And I'm going to present our newly adopted management plan for Schofield Reservoir. This plan was generated by a public involvement process that I'll briefly describe. We've used this same process for plans on Lake Powell, Fish Lake, Boulder Mountains, Starvation, and several others. It involves the public to the best of our abilities, and we generally get good buy-in with the product these generate.
Sure.
So just briefly, I wanted to talk about the history of Schofield. It was originally built in 1926. 20 years later, it was enlarged to its current size. And by 1958, they did their first rotenone treatment. And for those of you that don't know, rotenone is a chemical that affects aquatic animals and kills them, so targets fish. And that 1958 treatment was essentially for Utah chub, which are a very large minnow, long-lived, lay a lot of eggs, and they're direct competitors with trout, juvenile trout in particular. We weren't able to estimate the cost of that original treatment, but they treated and they went back in with rainbow trout and some various strains of cutthroat. 20 years later, they did it again for the same reason, for Utah chub again. And that treatment, in unadjusted dollars for inflation, was about $100,000. 14 years later, they did it again. This time it was for Utah chub. There were some common carp and also some illegally stocked walleye. And that treatment costed around $300,000. After that treatment, again, they went back in with rainbow trout and some various strains of cutthroat. So that kind of gives you a history of the challenges Schofield has had. I want to briefly talk about the history of use at Schofield. Over the years, we do creel surveys, which are year-long surveys that allow us to estimate total angling hours, which is total effort up there, the number of fish caught, the number of fish harvested. We can generate catch rates, harvest rates, things of that nature. What I want you to see here is on the bottom, 1986, there was an estimated 346,000 angling hours, which is a lot for a 2,200-acre reservoir. In 1997-98, we estimated use at about 278,000. In 2004 and 5, it was down to 114,000 hours. And in 2007, we did a kind of a truncated creel survey and estimated use at 55,000. In all of those years, fishing was good. Some of these were post-treatment. Fishing wasn't terrible, yet we saw a decrease in use. We see this at a lot of Utah reservoirs over the years. The exact reason we don't know, it's social to some extent. I think a lot of it has to do with the amount of opportunities and diversity we have now compared to then. There's just more places for people to go fish, other things competing with their time. So there was decreasing use out there, and it wasn't related to poor fishing. However, the survey we did in 2015, the hours were down to about 34,000, which was significantly down. So it became pretty clear we needed to do something out there. We needed to make some changes to reassess how we're managing it and figure out how to move into the future. So last fall, early winter, October, November, we initiated an online survey. It had 21 questions. And it also identified individuals that were willing to volunteer to be part of this management team. So from that group, I think we had actually 600 people volunteer, which impressed me. So we got some names, we put together a team, we tried to represent as many user groups and different interests as possible. We met right after the first of the year there in our Price office and had a kind of a marathon meeting. We had a couple other conference calls and review periods and things of that nature, sharing emails and conference call phones. And by about mid-March, we had a draft management plan ready for review. Initially, that was reviewed by our internal staff, some of our fisheries chief, of course, and some of our coordinators in Salt Lake, some other regional staff. After that, it was sent to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The UCRRP is the Upper Colorado River Recovery Program. And then the states of Colorado and Wyoming all reviewed this plan and had some comments, and we made some modification based on their feedback. And at that point, we considered it kind of finalized. We were really trying to hit the May RAC and Wildlife Board cycle, but we didn't get all the comments back quite in time for that. So we kind of had to take a little time off over the summer, and here we are tonight. The committee members, real quickly, we had representation from our Blue Ribbon Fisheries Council, the Southeastern RAC, Darris Jones, Mike King from the Wildlife Board participated, Ken Strong from SFW, the State Park Manager, Doug Cloward is a Schofield area cabin owner and resident up there, and then these anglers are primarily from the Wasatch Front. Historically, a little over 70% of the use at Schofield came from Utah and Salt Lake counties. So we tried to do that with our angling members. We tried to have a local guy and then heavily weighted towards the Wasatch, which is most of the use up there. So what was the purpose? Well, we wanted them to provide input and help us develop a management plan for Schofield. We determined a mission statement. They helped us set goals and objectives for the fishery. They made recommendations on how we were going to achieve those goals, and we tried to consider all interests and find common ground. Our mission statement: to develop a sport fish management plan that will provide the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources with recommendations and direction to create a sustainable and high-quality fishery at Schofield Reservoir. And we generated six goals. The first goal was to reestablish a family fishery and maintain a harvestable component. Over the last 7-8 years, we've pretty much lost the family fishery at Schofield. We are no longer stocking rainbow trout today simply because they won't perform in return. We're focused mostly on predatory species, primarily the Bonneville, Bear Lake cutthroat, and the tiger trout. So there's really nothing out there for the worm dunkers to catch right now. Goal number two, maintain and enhance trophy angling opportunities. Our management the last 7 or 8 years has created some incredible trophy opportunities. We created a period of several years where we were breaking the tiger trout state record, and now we have a lot of quality cutthroat trout in the population, and there's a group of people that don't want that to go anywhere. They want to keep that and even enhance it. The third thing that was clear from the survey and the group is that people wanted more diversity up there. We're going to do that with alternative fish species. The crux of the plan, the Utah chub, we need to reduce their numbers. We need to do that with some sort of sustainable management model, a one-time fix, and then come back 14 years later. Goal number five, increase angling and recreational use. The graph or the table I showed you, you know, we're losing anglers out there, and a lot of it recently is because of the quality of the fishery. And also our partners, our state park partners, have noticed, decreased visitation, and we need to try to improve that. Lastly, and certainly not leastly, manage Schofield Reservoir for compatibility with native species management. Schofield, of course, eventually connects to the Green and Colorado Rivers, where we have native state conservation species and then threatened and endangered species. With those T&E species, we have agreements on what we can stock and can't stock in this drainage. So we have to be really careful with how we manage our fisheries in this part of the state in particular. So real briefly, let's just talk about these six goals. The first one, to reestablish a family fishery. We're going to reinstate the stocking of rainbow trout using a larger size fish, and that will be a catchable size fish. Typically on a reservoir the size of Schofield, we don't use catchable fish because catchable fish are expensive. We can't put enough in there to maintain a catch rate that's acceptable. So what we usually do is use what we call a subcatchable size fish that's between 5 and 7 inches, and that fish is expected to go in the water, grow for a year, and become harvestable the next year. But we're going to start using these catchable fish next year so anglers have a rainbow trout that they can harvest immediately. After chub biomass is reduced through this plan, we'll go back to stocking that traditional size fish we usually have, the put, grow, and take type model. We're also going to use triploid, which are sterile walleye, and wipers, which are striped bass hybrids, they're a cross between striped bass and white bass, as part of the harvestable component. What we mean by that is we're not going to put any special regulations on those fish. They'll just be your regular statewide creel limits with no size limits. So we're not going to over-regulate those and get super restrictive, those new species. Enhanced trophy angling opportunities. We're going to continue using the cutthroat and the tiger trout like we are now, and the regulations, we have a slot limit on those fish that will remain. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to add those sterile walleye and wipers. And with the prey base out there, it's going to create some trophy opportunities just because there's a lot of food out there and they're going to utilize it. We're also going to use the tiger muskie as a predator and also as a trophy fish. We've used those at Joe's Valley, and they've been increasingly popular. They're an impressive fish when they get big. Enhance the diversity. Some of this is getting redundant because we're only adding three species. We're, of course, going to, again, stock the sterile walleye and the wipers and the tiger muskies. That's the added diversity that hasn't been there in the past. And then we'll continue with the rainbow trout, the tigers, and the cutthroat. So we'll have a few more species in there that have never been there before. We hope that'll attract a lot of interest and help us meet our goals. And this is the big one, the chubs. You know, we need to reduce those. We don't want to eliminate them completely, of course. We plan to use them to grow some big fish, but we do need to get their biomass down. Our management right now is working. What we've done is we've shifted the size structure of these chubs. They're all 10, 12 inches. You know, they look like the chubs in that bucket. Those are big. And there's no little ones left because all our trout are eating them. However, these chub can live for 20 years, 25 years, even 30. So we need to get more mouths out there that'll eat those bigger fish, whittle that number down for us. And that's where the walleyes, the wipers, and the tiger muskies will hopefully help us. And, of course, we're going to monitor the chub numbers very carefully. We've got a lot of goals or measurable numbers associated with all these goals and objectives. I didn't add those. Just gets into a lot of detail, but it's in the plan if you read it. So we're going to monitor those several times a year and more if necessary. The increased angling recreational use, both us as far as license sales and anglers, angling hours and state parks, think it's reasonable to increase our use angling and at the state park by 50% over the next 5 years. And Schofield Reservoir was on the Blue Ribbon Fisheries list primarily because it's always been an attractive family fishery. The Blue Ribbon Council removed that 2 years ago, I think, because we've lost that family component. I mean, it's still a great trophy fishery, but that's not the original reason it was on. So we hope we can reestablish Blue Ribbon Fishery designation. And then our native species concerns. We have signed a non-native stocking agreement that basically there's a big list of fish that we can use and we can't use. Even though the fish we're proposing being used are sterile, if they escape, they're not going to, you know, create a population. We're still worried about their escapement. So we need to put some sort of screen below the reservoir to minimize fish escapement. And we actually met today and discuss some options for doing that. This lower left picture is kind of just it's really a rigid fence. That's what we have at Starvation. When it spills, it stops walleye from moving downstream. The structure on the right's a $500,000 structure in Colorado. I hope we don't have to go there, but we do need to try to reduce fish escaping out of Schofield Reservoir and moving downstream. So that's a big part of this plan too. So let's talk about Rotenone real quick. Obviously, with these chubs, there were two ways to go. We could have gone biological, like we did with the plan, or we could have just Rotenone it again, like we've done, you know, every other decade for the last 50 years. The group decided, let's not do that. However, we're leaving Rotenone kind of as a plan B option. And we're currently we have a private consulting firm doing a NEPA analysis for us for a Rotenone treatment of Schofield, all its tributaries, and the tailwater. Clear down to Highway 6. Anytime we do some sort of action on federal property, which in this case is BOR, we do some sort of disturbance, we have to do a NEPA. So even though the lake was low last year and it would have been a perfect time to treat it, we can't just do that. You know, we have to go through these processes. So we're doing that right now, and we'll have that in our pocket in case we need it. And we've talked about, you know, it could cost $1 million to do a Rotenone treatment in today's dollars, depending on lake level. So we hope we don't have to go there, but we're planning it in the background just in case we do. And that's it. Those are a lot of the state record tigers that were caught the last few years.
This question.
So there's no action item on this, right, but we could accept comments or questions from the public or the RAC.
I like going last.
How long is your NEPA good for once it's completed?
It depends on, I think, the agency, but Darren, 5 to 7 years, is that right? It'll be BOR in this case.
Yeah, 5 to 7 years should be, yeah, maybe even a little longer.
And I failed to mention it. I should have. I meant to. This plan has roughly a lifespan of 5 years. If we're not meeting some of these chub reduction goals within 5 years, we're going to go to that option. It could be earlier than that, though. You know, we're adding some species up there that have never been there before, and if they don't perform and survive, you know, we might go to Rotenone earlier.
And that treatment, like, so when you were giving the earlier numbers, $100,000, $300,000, that doesn't incorporate reintroduction. Or you know,
no,
restocking.
That would be primarily the purchase of the chemical and then just manpower.
Right.
And it at this point, it's just kind of a rough estimate. It's in that neighborhood.
We do have a comment from the audience.
Okay.
Darius Jones.
I just wanted to kind of report, you know, I represented you guys at the
on this management committee. Being a game guy, not a fish guy, to kind of relate the room full of anglers was kind of like bringing in Henry's Mountain buck hunter, a cash general season buck hunter, maybe a couple Vernon guys and a Bookcliff guy, and trying to come to some kind of consensus on how big a buck to manage for. So Justin had his work cut out for him. The only consensus we had to begin with was get rid of the chubs. And there was a big push to let's not waste time, let's just poison and get on with it. And there was a lot of trophy fishermen there that caught some of those fish in the last few years, and they did not want to see that component go down to Rotenone. So I think the division and Justin did a fantastic job of bringing that kind of a polarized group together, and with the management implications he's got with new species, plus bringing back the old rainbow fishery, and on top of that he's got a contingency plan. So if this doesn't work, we're still going to get rid of chub. So just kudos to the division. They did a great job.
Question. So just to clarify, Darris Jones was a RAC member for the last 8 years. So yeah, his last term was back in May.
I have a question. With the predator species, will you continue to maintain those at the same time you're trying to introduce the rainbow fishery?
Yeah. I mean, we might have to reduce stocking rates, for example. Once some of the food's gone, obviously they're going to eat something else. So we may have to reduce wiper, walleye stocking, tiger muskie stocking a little bit, but we think we can maintain that diversity. This has kind of been replicated on some waters in the southern part of the state with wipers in particular and rainbow trout, and it's worked, but it's a balancing act. So in the plan, there's some language and some hard numbers that kind of answer that question you just asked me.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So if you do go to the treatment, do you offer up like a free fishing weekend? Just let people come?
Yeah, we'd liberalize the fishing limits for probably a year. They're draining Mill Site Reservoir up at Farron, and we quadrupled the limits in January. So yeah, we would.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So do I have to do anything else? Do we say meeting is adjourned?
You have to get your gavel out.
Is that it? Okay, meeting is adjourned.